Hello, everyone. This is Mysterious Topics Podcast. I am John. Before we get started, if you are planning to do any shopping at Amazon.com and would like to support this podcast, please go to our website, MysteriousTopics.com, and click on our Amazon link first. It will not cost you any extra, and we greatly appreciate your continued support. And also, if you do that, you can just bookmark that so you don't have to keep going back to the website. Just bookmark it and just use that every time. And again, it would help us out a great deal. Thank you. Mysterious Topics is now heading into uncharted territory. Since Chuck informed me he would be leaving the podcast, I've gone back and forth many times on whether to continue or not, and if so, how, what format. I have several ideas, all of which I will incorporate eventually, including interviews with guest experts as well as listeners, both of which I have done in the past. I would also like to offer to the listenership of the podcast the opportunity to be a guest host with me. I have already reached out to some people and would like to offer this to anyone who may be interested. That is one of the things that both Chuck and I found when we started doing this podcast with the people, the many people that corresponded with us, and how intelligent and nice they are and everything. And it's just been a real pleasure meeting the people that listen to this podcast. And at this point in time, I would really appreciate leaning on their support and help with this podcast and allow people to become part of it if they so wish to do that. And if you would like to, you simply pick a topic, send an email to me through the contact link at MysteriousTopics.com stating the topic and that you would like to act as a guest host on that topic. Also include your contact name on Skype so that I can send a request so that we can hook up that way, or you can send a contact request to my Skype name and I will send that to you if you want to do this. The other thing to keep in mind is the quality of the call depends on the type of microphone and speakers you're using, and the best thing to do would be to use headphones and a microphone. The easiest way to accomplish this would just be to use earbuds with a built-in mic that came with your smartphone. If you have a smartphone, or if you know somebody that does, or you can get these relatively inexpensive types of earbuds with a mic in them, and that would be the best way, as opposed to if you just use your laptop or tablet and you're using the built-in speaker and mics, it sounds kind of like a speakerphone call, and it's just not anywhere near as good a quality. So if you do this, I'll respond and set up a time for us to record, and that's pretty much it. You, of course, have to do a little research on the topic you want to do, and presumably some people already know quite a bit about the topic they choose, so I would just need a little time myself to do that, and then we'll set up a time to record it. People may still request a topic even if they do not want to be a guest host. I will only proceed with people who specifically say they would like to be a guest host. Right now, though, I would like to start Mysterious Topics 2.0, I guess you call it, with a Mysterious Topics in the News episode. So we've done a lot of topics before, Chuck and I, well over 200 of them, and on a bunch of different topics, and I just chose some stories that I found in the news relatively recently, within the last few months, that correlate to podcasts that we've done. So I thought I'd go through those right now for you.
Mysterious Topics Update.
And we did a podcast just recently on Leonardo da Vinci, and that was on July 24th of 2016 this year. And I found this article at businessinsider.com from July of this year also. And it's titled, Da Vinci's Irrelevant Doodles Actually Contain His Most Revolutionary Physics Discovery. Until now, art historians dismissed some doodles in Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks as irrelevant. But a new study from Ian Hutchings, a professor at the University of Cambridge, shows that one page of these scribbles from 1493 actually contains something groundbreaking. The first written records demonstrating the laws of friction. Although it has been common knowledge that Da Vinci conducted the first systematic study of friction, which underpins the modern science of tribology or the study of friction, lubrication, and wear, we didn't know how and when he came up with these ideas. Hutchings was able to put together a detailed chronology pinpointing Da Vinci's aha moment to a single page of scribbles penned in red chalk in 1493. According to Gizmodo, the page drew attention toward the beginning of the 20th century because of a faint etching of a woman near the top, followed by Cosa bella mortal passa e non dura, which translates to mortal beauty passes and does not last. But a 1920s museum director dismissed the page as irrelevant notes and diagrams in red chalk. Almost a century later, Hutchings thought this page was worth a second look. He discovered that the rough geometrical figures drawn underneath the red notes show rows of blocks being pulled by a weight hanging over a pulley. In exactly the same kind of experiment students might do today to demonstrate the laws of friction. The sketches and text show Leonardo understood the fundamentals of friction in 1493, Hutchins said in a University of Cambridge press release. He knew that the force of friction acting between two sliding surfaces is proportional to the load pressing the surfaces together, that friction is independent of the apparent area of contact between the two surfaces. These are the laws of friction that we nowadays usually credit to a French scientist, Guillaume Amontoms, working 200 years later. Hutchings was also able to show how Da Vinci used his understanding of friction to sketch designs for complex machines over the next two decades. Da Vinci recognized the usefulness and effectiveness of friction and worked the concept into the behavior of wheels, axles, and pulleys, integral components of his complicated machines. Leonardo's 20-year study of friction, which incorporated his empirical understanding into models for several mechanical systems, confirms his position as a remarkable and inspirational pioneer of tribology, Hutchings said. And, of course, we talked about some of his drawings in that podcast, and people can go back and listen to that if they missed it. But I think we've all seen some of those drawings of, for instance, devices that look like helicopters and other things that weren't around for many hundreds of years later that he was conceiving. And obviously he didn't build those things, but he could already foresee those that many years before. And so this may not be surprising that he understood a great deal that wasn't supposedly really discovered for many years later, many hundreds of years later. I guess that shouldn't be surprising. But again, as we talked about on that podcast, just how did he come up with these ideas so many years before?
Mysterious Topics Update.
Now, we did a show towards the very beginning of our podcast on October 24th of the year 2014 about those mysterious Siberian holes that were showing up. Just a big hole. And now there's an update, a story just recently out from July 21st of 2016 from TechInsider.com by Sarah Kramer titled "The Ground in Siberia is Turning into a Trampoline and We Should All Be Worried." The ground in Siberia has been behaving strangely for a while now. Remember those insanely giant craters that opened up out of nowhere? And how recently one of them exploded so violently that you could hear it from 60 miles away? You can add this to the list of strange things that the ground really shouldn't do. Why is the ground bouncing like some sort of unholy trampoline? And on the link to this story, you can see an actual little video of somebody pushing with their boot into the ground, and it's just, it looks like a big water balloon under the grass. According to a story at the Siberian Times, scientists aren't totally sure yet, but it's probably for similar reasons to those terrifying hellmouth craters that keep opening up. The unseasonably warm weather in the Arctic regions, and let's be honest, everywhere, is causing permafrost, the ground that should literally be permanently frozen, to thaw. When permafrost thaws into soft soil, the liquid methane trapped underneath is released as a gas. This seems to be the case here. The research team who discovered the 15 or so patches of wobbly ground told the Siberian Times that methane and carbon dioxide emanated from the patch when they pierced it. Methane and carbon dioxide are potent greenhouse gases, which trap heat in the atmosphere. One study found that if permafrost all over the world releases the gases bottled up underground, then we could double the amount of carbon emissions in the atmosphere. So not only is the weird behavior of the Siberian tundra probably a result of climate change, but it could also potentially bring about a whole bunch more of it. And that's a scary thought. And it is a scary thought to think about. Our Earth is obviously warming, and just all the things that are happening. And we'll get to another story of a similar result of this global warming situation in just a little bit.
Mysterious Topics Update.
But now we go to another update of a podcast we did. This one correlates to the Malibu Underwater UFO Base podcast from October 23rd of 2014. And the title of this is, Did the U.S. Navy Build Super Secret Undersea Layers for Its Nuclear Submarine? This is by Steve Weintz, August 6th of 2016. Point Sur is 600 feet of tough rock facing Pacific rollers that come 6,000 miles to pound the central California coast. Like the 19th century lighthouse that marks the point, the now derelict compound of the former Navy facility, Point Sur, evokes another era. And it evokes a mystery, one involving secret underground naval bases, high-tech submarines, and Cold War nuclear brinkmanship. As late as the 1960s, Navy technicians and their families at Point Sur monitored undersea listening posts used to track Soviet submarines. According to one legend, it wasn't merely hydrophones the Navy ran from Point Sur, but submarines themselves, based in giant man-made caverns dug into the rock. There is something mythic and compelling about seashore scarps and naval bases, something drawing on archetypal imagery of treasure concealed in cave waters open to the sea. The ultimate supervillain's lair, after all, is an island base with undersea access. But as history has proven time and again, even the weirdest fantasies have their real-life counterparts, and those who dive for Atlantean gold sometimes surface with treasure. There really were and are some strange ideas deep down in the sea. By 1966, two surges into outer space and inner space were at the flood tide. While NASA gathered ever more momentum with monthly Gemini flights and a new mission control, the success of SeaLab 2 and the Conchel 3 underwater habitat led to a presidential commission on oceanography and a bigger undersea commitment. The Navy's efforts to recover a lost hydrogen bomb off the coast of Spain that year and the loss of the attack sub USS Thresher 3 years before had brought new funding and discipline to deep submergence systems. In such heady times, dreams of colonizing the continental shelf within a generation seemed like sober predictions. It was in this environment that C.F. Austin of the China Lake Naval Ordnance Test Station proposed the rock site concept. Manned undersea installations excavated into the rock of the seafloor. By applying well-understood principles employed for decades by the mining industry, Austin proposed that large bases could be constructed and operated anywhere suitable bedrock occurred in the ocean, at any depth. Austin realized that even with mid-1960s technology, it would be possible to sink a wide shaft into the seafloor, seal it and drain it, then use it as a staging area for further excavation. A tunnel boring machine could be lowered into the shaft in pieces and then assembled to bore out more tunnels, including one for a small modular nuclear reactor, much like those used at Camp Century in Greenland and McMurdo Base in Antarctica. There's very little hype in Austin's report. The bulk of it is taken up with documentation of tunneling methods and mining operations conducted under the seafloor. These often follow seams and drifts underground as they continue offshore. According to Austin, one Nova Scotia mine, Dominion Coal's Cape Breton operation, consisted of a complex of many consolidated undersea mines ranging in depth from 200 to 2,700 feet below the seafloor, with a water cover of 60 to 100 feet. These mines span an area of approximately 75 miles and presently employ some 4,100 men in the undersea workings. Among the benefits of rock site, Austin noted its immunity to weather and currents, its shirt-sleeve environment, and its very controlled access. And Austin was not thinking small. Structures within the seafloor can easily be made large and comfortable enough to permit the quartering of crews and their families for extended periods of time, he wrote, and can be made large enough to serve as supply and repair depots for large submersibles. Recent research on hardened missile basing concepts have proven various techniques for creating submarine-sized structures in hard substrates. The Air Force's development of underground silos, subways, and central commands produce real-world hardware and experience with construction techniques. In the 1970s, the Los Alamos National Lab investigated an atomic rock drilling concept called the nuclear subterranean, which, like rock site, sounds like something out of Johnny Quest, but also really happened. One wonders what might have happened had the Navy put its nuclear expertise to work drilling holes in the ocean floor. For anyone that doesn't know, Johnny Quest was a great animated cartoon series that ran when I was a kid. It's just a really excellent show. If there are any kids out there, they should try to look that up on YouTube or something, because it's very good. It was a very well done, they called it at the time, a cartoon. But if you like the topics we're talking about in this podcast, you'll definitely enjoy Johnny Quest. The rock site concept also bore much in common with NASA's designs for underground moon bases. Very likely, all three concepts, invulnerable bastions, space outposts, and ocean bases, would have shared solutions to issues ranging from environmental control to crew morale. Austin foresaw that rock site bases could be ideal for industrial uses such as fossil fuel production and deep sea mining. In the decades since Austin's study, industry has created the tools needed to realize his vision. Though it's not atomic powered, the world's largest tunnel boring machine is about to drill a 2-mile-long tunnel beneath Seattle, wide enough to hold an Ohio-class sub. One enterprising firm servicing the offshore renewables industry has designed a remote drilling rig for planting monopile anchors on the seafloor, while others are developing entire subsea electrical grids. Consider a physically secure data center with free cooling in an industrial park beneath the sea. Did the Navy ever actually pursue the rock site concept at Point Sur or elsewhere? A 1971 study discussed various methods of seafloor excavation, but by then, most man-in-the-sea development was classified. In the absence of information, fantasy takes wings. Or maybe that's fins. But nearly 50 years later, C.F. Austin's dream remains both sober and dazzlingly novel. And we have talked in past podcasts about subterranean bases, of course, the one I referred to in the beginning of this. I was just thinking that this sounds, when they first discovered that off the coast of Malibu, embedded into the sea wall, I guess you'd call it, quite deep down, going in, looked like some sort of man-made opening that was going into the underneath the United States, basically, underneath California. And we were talking about all the possibilities. Does it run all the way to the Denver airport or what? Or was it aliens that built it? Or it was very well could have just been our government or our military that did that. And of course, they're not going to say they did that. They don't want us to know. So they just make that story sound like, well, it's just somebody's goofy thoughts thinking that, and it's just a natural formation and there's nothing to see here, folks. Move along. So I think it's interesting when these kind of stories come out, and it just makes you think.
Mysterious Topics Update.
Now, we did several podcasts about Antarctica. One of them on Lake Vostok was from February 8th of 2015. And this is an update on that area. And this is from ecowatch.com from August 25th of 2016. This is by Dan Zukowski, titled "Delaware-sized chunk of ice could dislodge from Antarctic shelf." An 80-mile-long crack in the Larsen Sea ice shelf threatens to dislodge a chunk of ice measuring about 2,300 square miles, nearly the size of Delaware, and twice the size of the massive Larsen B ice shelf collapse in 2002. As the long southern hemisphere polar night is ending, satellites have been able to see that the rift has grown nearly 14 miles, or about 3 miles per month. Since it was last observed in March 2016, the fracture in the ice has also widened from 200 meters, or 656 feet, to about 350 meters, or 1,148 feet, according to Project Midas, a UK-based Antarctic research project. As this rift continues to extend, it will eventually cause a large section of the ice shelf to break away as an iceberg. Researchers who have reviewed satellite imagery dating back to 1963 have determined that destabilization of the Larsen B ice shelf was already underway at that time and began accelerating in more recent decades. Prior to that, it had been stable for 12,000 years. Between January and April of 2002, the ice shelf began to break apart, eventually losing a 1,235 square mile area into the sea. At that time, it was the largest collapse ever seen. Antarctic ice shelves, which ride atop ocean waters, ring the continent and hold back land-based glaciers. The most vulnerable regions are in West Antarctica and the Antarctic Peninsula. Ice shelves in this region protect a very large portion of glacial ice. The Earth's crust jumped upward following the collapse of the Larsen B. Sensitive GPS instrumentation around the ice shelf show that tectonic uplift is now 1.8 centimeters per year as the disappearance of glaciers allows the Earth below to rebound. However, some of the ice in the shelves is considered passive by scientists in that it doesn't play any role in buttressing glaciers. Some scientists think this may be the case with the Larsen C ice shelf. The most recent event was the disintegration of the Wilkins ice shelf in 2009, the 10th major ice shelf collapse in modern times. Scientists cannot predict the timing of the Larsen C collapse, but say it could happen in the next 2 to 3 years. A study published in 2015 showed that Larsen C is rapidly thinning, having lost 4 meters or 13 feet between 1998 and 2012. As the ice thins, it is susceptible to melting from underneath. Of itself, the loss of this portion of the ice shelf will not raise sea levels as it is already floating on the water. However, as these ice shelves disintegrate, the landlocked glaciers they hold back may begin sliding into the sea. If all of the ice the Larsen C ice shelf holds back slides into the ocean, it will raise sea levels globally by 4 inches. Warmer air temperatures were blamed for the collapse of Larsen B. By melting the top layer, pools of meltwater form and seep through crevices, causing fracturing of the ice. This process is now being seen on the Langhoved Glacier in East Antarctica, on the opposite side of the continent from the Larsen Ice Shelf. Temperatures at the Antarctic Peninsula, where the Larsen Ice Shelf is found, have risen by 2.5 degrees Celsius in the past 50 years. On March 24, 2015, a record high of 63.5 degrees Fahrenheit was recorded on the peninsula at Esperanza Base. Antarctica is losing ice at a rate of 25 cubic kilometers or 6 miles per year. Current Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change estimates of sea level rise do not account for this rate of loss. I think it's just really hard to understand just how much ice are in the permafrost regions, Antarctica and Greenland, and how much ice is there, but how fast it's melting. It's quite alarming.
Mysterious Topics Update.
And finally, on a slightly lighter note to end the show, we have a story. We did a story on animals and humans helping each other from April 24th of 2016 this year. And this is an article that appeared August 16th, 2016 by Kit Steinkellner on Yahoo.com, and it's titled, "This Dog Actually Heard Her Family Was Looking for Her." It always makes our hearts sink to see missing dog signs on telephone poles, knowing that sadly, so many dogs and cats that go missing don't come home. It was a scary situation for Kansas City local Kelly Schaefer when her husband Alfred, who has Alzheimer's, and their beloved dog, 5-year-old Bichon poodle Tabitha, disappeared one day last year. Alfred was fortunately found, but Tabitha wasn't. The Schaefers did what anyone does when a beloved dog goes missing. They pulled out all the stops to get their girl home. In addition to putting up nearly 300 flyers, the Missouri couple went on the local news to plead with the community to help bring their little girl home. Cut to Tabitha, who was safe and well and had been taken into another home. When Tabitha heard Kelly and Alfred's voices on the news broadcast, she recognized them and made it clear to the people that had taken her in that this was her real family on the news. Once confirmed, Tabitha was returned to Kelly and Alfred, and everybody's heart grew 3 sizes. And I just think that's amazing to hear that this little dog heard them on the television or radio, I'm not sure which, but she heard the owner's voices and she began barking. And this happened apparently more than once. And the people that had her, I wouldn't think they would have figured out it was her anyway if they were putting up these signs. But as soon as they went on TV showing pictures of the dog, and these people obviously knew that they found this dog as a stray. But as soon as the dog started barking, they definitely knew, and they did the right thing, and they returned the dog to the owners. And any one of us who has any kind of pet, dog or cat that's gone missing, and to have it returned, it just is such a gratifying feeling for the people that got the dog back and for the people that were able to safely return the pet to its family. For links to these stories and many other topics, you can go to our website, mysteriestopics.com. Thank you all for listening. Goodbye.